2,000 people killed in the first half of 2019, up to 47 people murdered in stabbings and shootings one weekend. With Bishop Lavis, Mitchell Splane, Delft, Alsis River, Nyanga, Khayelitsha, Mfuleni, Philippi, Kryfontein and Manenberg being named as the most dangerous areas. But now the military is getting ready to leave, and it's hard to measure how it helped our communities combat decades of violence and its aftermath in 3 months. AllAfrica.com and Bush Radio want to know what the next steps are. And our moderator for the discussion on this will be Juanita Williams for AllAfrica.com, the world's largest electronic distributor of African news. So good afternoon, and I'm Jasmine Roberts, and welcome to Sakisi's We're Building the Nation, Bodi Nasi on Bush Radio 89.5 FM.
Good afternoon, I'm Juanita Williams. As Jasmine said, I'm the managing editor of AllAfrica.com. We want to talk today about how to build the peace that we need in our communities, especially as the impact of gang violence and the raw emotions around violence against women and xenophobic attacks are sweeping South Africa. In the studio today, we have Wilhelmina van Dyk, who is a community and gender activist who lives in Alsis River, that's been involved in gender initiatives and community forums such as the Community Policing Forum, Safety Forums, and was currently involved in the LGBTI sector through Triangle Projects. Then we have Dr. Guy Lam, a peace-building practitioner and director of the Safety and Violence Initiative. Zenit Isaacs, chairperson and founder of SMART, supporting mentorship through art. Professor Dr. Chance Chagunda, program manager for the Whitaker Peace and Development Initiative. So first we're going to go to, now that I've mentioned all the people that are in studio, we're going to leave the studio for a bit. We're going to go to the streets. We asked people on the streets of Salt River and Woodstock, because you know that this is a hub where people come and work. So people are from all the different areas in Cape Town, how the violence has affected their lives.
Now it's terrible. I don't like it. Government must do something about it, because we're not safe. We as women and our children are not safe, especially in our place where I stay, Crossroads, and that side of Samora, Crossroads. Oh, it's very terrible. They're killing others, shooting others, rob the people. Even the Ubers, they're not coming that side. They rob the Ubers, so it's not right.
Yeah, too much, man, because I've got a problem. They stole my clothes in my house and the blanket, and they took my phone when I am going to station. I lost 4 phones at Philip next to station.
It's so scary, because right now I'm just even scared to even go to shops, because we used to be scared at night, but now we're actually even scared at daylight, and it's very unfortunate.
It made me kind of hard, man. It affects me, you know, what some people that you can so much see, like you come out of a community, it's affected by violence and see drug abuse and gangsterism and all of that. But I'm not a gangster, and it affected me kind of in a positive way and kind of in a negative way.
Nowadays, the shootings, actually with the small children, and that, it really affects us, because young children are dying where they could have gone and get an education for school.
It's basically a negative impact on everyone that is in the community, and it makes you angry at the point where you just want to lose control. If you see someone basically do something wrong, but at the end of the day, you need to face the fact and move on and try and make your community better.
It made me very scared to be outside. Like, I don't walk outside at all. Even walking to the transport in the morning, and I'm always panicky walking outside. So I'm not comfortable at all walking in my community. If I see somebody sketchy, I'm always either walking into somebody's house, or I turn around and I walk away.
My wife said, man, children grow up in an environment that is not safe and inducive for young kids. So you need to control your kids. It starts with the family. The mother and the father needs to take control of the kids first and teach them how to face the world, because the world is, it's a mess.
It's a people.
To the point where you don't want to walk outside, those kind of things. You're always anxious of your surroundings, conscious of what's going to happen to you, would anything happen to you next. Like, it's an emotional torment, basically.
A part of our daily life
atheists, the violence, selling drugs. The drugs is the main thing. The government must do something about the drugs, because if the drugs are there, every thing will fall into place. The government must also give work to those people standing on the corners, because they break in your house, they rob you, they kill you, just to go and get the next fix.
They broke into my car 3 times, stole my amplifier, CDs, special CDs. That's how the violence affected me. And it's not the violence, it's the drugs.
It was in a week's day, a month ago, while I was standing at the bus stop, 2 guys was passing me, shooting on one another. And I was standing there, and I think I was just covered under the blood of Jesus. Because if it wasn't for him, I could have been killed. And yeah, violence is taking over.
So yeah, there you have it. Violence is taking over. And that's what we're talking about today. We're talking about how we can actually make our communities more peaceful. We've now spoken to people that are from different areas on the in Cape Town, but now we're going to find out the personal experiences of Wilmina van Dyk and Zenit Isaacs.
Good morning, everybody, once again. Personal experiences this week alone. If we can start it like that already, I think that's the scariest thing. And that my cousin's husband was stabbed on his way to work, leaving his house at 5 o'clock in the morning and having to go down the road, which is more than 500 kilometers, meters away. He got stabbed, you know. A few weeks ago, he stopped a robbery as well in the same road. So what is being done at the moment? Not that much. People are really trying their best, and it seems to take forever to come off. There's no real support. You know, we've got a brilliant initiative in Alsace River, which I'm not, I haven't asked whether I could speak on it, but it is Inspire Alsace. So, you know, it's a brilliant initiative. It started by community people, community activists, people who became activists because of the violence, having been personally affected. The woman whose brother has, whose sister's son has yesterday been picked up with a car full of drugs. She is not actively involved. So it seems like people are either waiting to be affected, or they're trying, those who knows that something is, are trying their best. It's just difficult, you know, the attitude towards people working within the sector, and from government side and from the community side as well, you know.
Zenit, thank you, Wilmina. Zenit, tell us what your experiences have been in Mitchell's Plain and about some of your work as well.
Okay, so from my MPO side, the reporting is from 3 weeks ago. We have a little baby C, we'll just mention her as baby C. The gender-based violence in Mitchell's Plain, it's rising, and these incidents that are reported, and some, because of lack of education, go unreported. It's really sad. This is baby C. We start with her. She was one of the first. So we are MPO situated, one of the first surrounding victims, which is really sad because she's a 1.5-year-old baby. The second incident was one of our very close participants that is involved in all of our workshops. We lost her. That was a week after baby C's incident, Janika. And my heart goes out to Janika and her family. She is from the surrounding areas and one of the impoverished schools that we work at. Then the third incident came to my ears last night, and I'm still shaking, like I'm sitting here. It's little Akhil, and he is from the same school. And this is within the same vicinity, the same area. So, yes, I do agree with the previous speaker, but also I strongly believe that there's still hope. The issues I feel is basically focused on a lack of education, number one, then a lack of employment, number two. So if we look at those issues and we target that and we look at self-sustainability, I mean, incorporate that, and like one of the speakers previously said, it starts at home. And we look at all those situations and we put it into a full package and basically take that out into the areas of need, I feel there will be a difference made.
So we asked the Community Safety MEC of Cape Town what is actually being, why has it not been tackled successfully, the issue of violence on the Cape Flats? And he was not able to be in the studio, MEC Albert Fritz, but he was able to send us through voice notes. WhatsApp is a wonderful thing, isn't it? He was able to send through voice notes to any spokesperson, Kayla Murray, commented on those issues.
The Minister of Community Safety, Albert Fritz, released findings on the State of Detective Services report on the 23rd of July 2019. The report assessed the under-resourcing of the detective services, training competencies, the effect of under-resourcing on detection and convictions, and provided recommendations going forward. The Department of Community Safety has a constitutional mandate to exercise oversight over the SAPs. As such, an assessment was conducted over the Western Cape Detective Services, which looked at 150 Western Cape police stations operating between the 1st of July 2017 and the 31st of December 2017. The purpose was to assess the level of compliance based on SAP standards, prescripts, and instructions. Minister Fritz said, "Ultimately, detectives are responsible for gathering evidence and facts for criminal cases. Their critical services include interviewing potential suspects, examining records, and apprehending criminals. The quality of their work determines whether a case is solved or dropped. Unfortunately, not only are there resource shortages and a lack of training amongst our detectives, but our detectives are also completely overburdened. Upon concluding the assessment of the detective services, it was found of the total detectives in the Western Cape, 48% had a caseload of over 200 dockets per person, which is 333% above the 50 to 60 case norm. Minister Fritz said, "At present, the Western Cape does not have enough detectives to investigate the spate of criminality and gangsterism in the province. There is a shortage of 548 detectives in the Western Cape, and 142 posts currently remain vacant. The assessment further highlighted that there is a need to allocate an additional 443 posts to priority stations in the Western Cape. Without these detectives, conviction rates for gang-related crime will remain low. In terms of training competencies, of the 2,785 detectives in the Western Cape, 91.7% have not received training in the specialized detective learning program. 88.2% have not been trained to investigate fraud. 57% of the detective commanders have not completed the requisite training, and 45.8% did not complete the basic detective learning program." Minister Fritz said, "These numbers are deeply shocking as they highlight that many detectives have not received the adequate specialized training to investigate the organized and gang-related crime which runs rampant in the province. Not only are they insufficiently skilled, but their lives are equally put at risk when they are out in the field as they do not understand the dynamics at play. Under-resourcing and a lack of training have dire consequences on the detection of crime and safety of our citizens. Hence, 85% of cases monitored during the assessment were struck off the court roll. To break these figures down further, of the 875 cases monitored during this assessment, 380 dockets did not arrive at court. 417 investigations were not complete. 37 witnesses were not present in court, and 41 forensic reports were not available." Minister Fritz said, "What is particularly alarming is the finding that 71% of detectives have no informers. For detectives to become proactive in their fight against crime, they must strengthen their intelligence collection capacity by using the legal framework and funds made available to them. This will allow them to recruit and use informants within community, without which they will not be able to proactively predict and prevent crime."
That was information from Community Safety MEC Albert Fritz, delivered by spokesperson Kayla Murray. As the MEC said, those are shocking statistics. We do have another Vox Pop where we went out to the street and we asked people, why do you think South Africa has such high levels of crime? We'll play that a little bit later. I just want to remind everybody that they are able to engage with us on our WhatsApp number, which is 061-862-1065. That's 061-862-1065. That's WhatsApp. Or you can call us in studio at 021-448-6266. 021-448-6266. So let's go to the why South Africa is such has such high levels of violent crime and find out what people had to say.
Look, it's the unemployment rate. South Africa got a very high unemployment rate. So with the unemployment rate being so high, it's obviously with people, they're going to steal, they're going to murder, they're going to kill, they're going to do anything.
I think it's because the crime, it's all about people. Like we leaders say too. I think it's all about a crime. And then we'll go about abasizansi, like the society thinks it's okay by ANZE crime because it's all about people.
I think crime rate is high because of poverty, because of the unemployment. There's a lot of youngsters unemployed. Our rate of youngsters' employment is quite high, like in any way in the world. So people do crime, support families. Not only crime to support the drug habits, but because of poverty, the other youngsters are on drugs. They don't have any direction. People don't give them opportunity. So that is why I think crime rate is high in South Africa.
I think there's a crime even in drugs. There's too much drugs. Up in Cape Town, especially up in Cape Town, food. Napina, the unemployment.
Guy Lam and Dr. Chance Chagunda, Chagunda, are also in the studio with us, and they are peace building practitioners. They focus on building peace in communities on a level that is sort of academic, I suppose, but also they have all the facts and statistics at their fingertips. Why do you think South Africa is such a violent has so much violent crime?
Well, that's a kind of a complex question, and a complex question always results in complex answers. So let me not get into the utter complexities of it. Just as a kind of a background, myself and a former colleague of mine, Giselle Wharton, were commissioned by a kind of government department linked to the presidency to actually do a report about why is crime in South Africa so violent. So there's a number of ways of thinking about this, and a very helpful framework of doing this is something called the socio-ecological framework, which kind of sees violence as occurring at different levels. So violence happens, or their determinants for violence, because of things about yourself as a person, happen because of your immediate surroundings, namely within your family and the relationships you have, also because of the community that surrounds you, and then because of the society in which you live. So it's these kind of four levels that explain it. And really, our understandings on this, for violence to happen, it's usually this kind of combinations of risk factors for violence. So these risk factors come together and they result in violence. And sort of an analogy that I've used on a number of occasions before is South Africa is a bit like a perfect storm of these risk factors. So we have, at all levels, very high levels of risk for violence. So particularly around, a big driver of this is actually children having experienced violence or witnessed domestic violence or had traumatic events during their childhood. That has tendencies much later in life to either, in some cases, make them perpetrators or in some cases, make them victims. So we have very good research about that. We also know in families.
Dr. Chagunda has a chance as well to speak about what his experience of South Africa has been in his research.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. The Whittaker Peace and Development Initiative, which I'm heading in South Africa, is just new. That we had to do a preliminary findings in terms of the extent of violence and the causes of it. So my colleague has already mentioned Guy. I think for us, many were focusing on job creation and peace building. So that is linked in terms of what are the causes. So I've picked some of them, which is unemployment. And then we are providing an intervention in the whole of Cape Flats in terms of how do we empower the young people and also give them resources to start businesses. So that can reduce an employment, which is linked to the cause of violence. And the second, they were working with the schools and other communities in terms of educating kids from the very younger age, the importance of peace, so that this can counteract the bigger population, which is older majority of people that are involved in violent acts.
Thank you so much. We're talking about peace building on the Cape Flats and the violence that has been tearing through the Cape Flats for decades. We want to open the floor now so that everybody can have time to speak about the experiences and what is being done. And also, if we can just remember what the MEC said in terms of what the causes are of the violence not being tackled successfully. And maybe we can start with you, Wilhelmina.
Yeah. Guy said something very interesting, and I think that is an extremely important part when we look at violence in our communities in terms of how children experience violence and where it happens, in the houses, they become acquainted. And the one focus that I've always had throughout I've been a community development worker nearly all my life, all my adult life, I've always worked in communities. And the thing that hit me all the time and every time is how people respond to trauma. Trauma has become so part of our daily living. And where children are concerned, when you look in the streets now of our communities, the poor communities, you see children of the ages of 7 to 10 walking in groups being identified as gangsters, you know? And yes, it is a SAPS issue. It is a legal issue. However, I think to a large extent, we are negating the psychological impact of violence on people in general, because children do not learn how to become gangsters. It's not a course they do. They grow up into it. And it is not a new thing. Aftercare programs when I was at school in the 80s, and from there already you'd have kids preparing themselves to go to jail because most of their family members are already in jail, and that is what we need. I greatly feel that if we can start tackling the psychological impact, really tackling it, because I do believe that South Africa has a way of negating psychological impact of violence.
Yeah, I think the it's deep rooted in our society. Yes. Violence is, and so when you speak about that trauma, I completely, because coming from Mitchell's Plain, you grow up in that kind of environment, you know, and to get out of it, it's not as simple as sending the army to monitor what is going on.
No, most definitely, I totally agree with both of you. What I would say is what we found. So far, like, our statistical data has shown, like, from my MPO, that there's a huge impact made when we introduce those young people to things that are introduced into less impoverished areas. For example, you look at one of the schools we work at in Tafelsig, and then you compare it to a Waldorf private school. And, oh my word, how? What a difference. And you actually do the same, incorporate the same extramurals into that school. And there is a huge difference. So in the beginning, for example, with artwork, a child will be sitting with a sheet or a canvas, and they'll be drawing gang signs on there. And then later on, after you've gone through your workshops with them, you will see an actual beautiful artwork piece coming out, whether it be pottery, whether it be, and these are the things our youth is not exposed to. So why isn't this incorporated? That's my question, into our school systems. Yes. Why is it a plain school system? Okay, you arrive here at 8 o'clock, it's sort of prison like. Whereas you look at your private schools, so it's as if they're getting our youth, our kids, to be in this system. And at the end of the day, a lot of people that come from a background that's suffering, you don't have food on your table. You don't have a slice of bread or butter or anything to go to school with. You grow up that way, you become an adult, and jail offers you 3 free meals a day, 3 furry blanket, and yeah, you're chilled. You're chilled. You don't actually have to go work to do something with the high rate of unemployment that we're faced with. So what I'm trying to do now is teach people self-sustainability. People don't know that there's beauty in a green earth. People don't know that if you grow things, that those things that grow, you can feed your family with. So it starts with the young ones. And like Wilhelmina said earlier, it starts also at home. So if we teach those parents, and some of the kids don't have parents, and we teach the child, and we teach the caregiver, then we can change.
Yeah. Let me link the issue of children and the youth and the interventions. You know, the time that we have started working in the Cape Flats, and we have been trying to recruit young men and women to be peace builders, peace ambassadors. But the experience that we got when we recruit, some of them have refused, they don't want to be part of it. And when you ask them why, quite a number of them, they say, I witnessed how my father, my brother was killed, and I know who did it, and I cannot join the peace building network until I revenge, you know. And that just shows how many do have that, and how many join in order to do that revenge, you know. Mm. So for us, we are still taking, believing that once we recruit the young people and train them, they'll be able to be the first ambassadors for peace, and that can spread. And those that do not have that opportunity, that they are no longer youth, we also have other programs in terms of community dialogues where we have to share about peace building, you know. Because if there's no peace, we can forget about development. And these two go together. So the lack of development can fuel in the violence. So to understand what is happening now, I think we need a credible institution and do the impact assessment or outcome once the army have moved out. So we can start speaking, was it beneficial to have the army? To what extent? Because anecdotal evidence in the way we work around it seems there's took so much killing, even more than how they were before the army came in. And other new groups of gangs that we have just said that actually there are new ones. When, if you check the timeline, it's just this time that the IM have also been active. So we need some other objective information or outcome that can shed light. What would be the good intervention? You know, is it the army? Is it bring stakeholders together? Is it bring institutions, researchers, the community themselves, and so on? So we need to start seeing an integrated approach that can be pursued in the Cape Flats.
Just ready to respond to that and to the previous two comments, I think it's really important that we focus on children and young people, because the studies that have been done out there really kind of emphasize that if you support young people, you provide them with the socio-psychological support, you provide them with kindness, that, you know, young people who may be exposed to violence on a daily basis but can go to a safe space where they experience kindness, where they experience positive role models and adults who care, that can make a huge difference to the kind of trajectory or pathway of that child. And that's, you know, what internationally the WHO, World Health Organization's research has pointed that out. I just want to raise another issue, and it's around related to peace building and kind of preconditions. And I think a key challenge that we've been facing in South Africa at the moment, particularly in Cape Town, is around firearms and firearm violence. So in most conflict situations, when a peace process starts, the first thing that happens is you get rid of the firearms. Because there's this realization that your efforts in building peace can be really, really undermined if you can't reduce access, particularly to illegal firearms. And I think that's been a key challenge in Cape Town, is that due to police corruption, that we saw more than 2,000 firearms go directly to gangs about 8 or 9 years ago. And those firearms have really, when we saw those firearms introduced into Cape Town, that when it made a major difference in terms of murders and other violent crimes going up and inter-gang conflict. So I think it's kind of the sense of around all these initiatives around peace building, we need to get them moving. We need to get them moving as quickly as possible. But at the same time, the police also need to emphasize on collecting as many illegal firearms as possible. And that needs to be one of their key priorities, because firearms make up about more than a third of murders. They're responsible for more than a third of murders in South Africa.
Speaking about firearms, I mean, it's also a level of family violence that happens. And so one of the WhatsApps we received is, what can be done at the family level to curb violence?
Yeah, what can be done? I think our families needs guidance, real guidance. The parent center is doing great work, but it's situated in one area, and it needs to spread. And also, we need to be cognizant of what we speak of when we say family violence in an area like Alsace River. What does it mean? What does it entail? You know, because many of our people don't see violence as violence anymore, because it's become a norm. We've lived with it for all our lives. So, you know, that's where you get comments like, ah, it's not really that big an issue. Don't make an issue out of it, you know. It comes from there, because violence is part of our daily living. It is our norm. A husband hitting his wife, why must she go make an issue out of it? You get stories, somebody, a community activist telling you, oh, well, that girl standing there, a few feet away from us, oh, she was raped last week, and she was so distraught she was off work for 2 weeks. That is how we respond to violence, you know? And this girl hearing you speak of her rape, and she just says, hi, I'm okay now. So we need to start looking at what is perceived as violence in our communities specifically, and we need to start addressing that. When you look at families, what is a family in the community? What is the violence they experience, and do they understand it as violence? Does a mother hitting a child, is that violence? The father hitting the mother, is that violence? The mother swearing at the father, is it violence? What is violence? We need to define this, and we need to define it within context.
So, yeah, firstly, I'd like to say that I totally agree with you. Everything you said, spot on. So we face the lack of education, like I said previously. So people will come out in areas like Elsie's, Mitchell's Plain. We work in Langa as well. I work in Philippi, in Googs, and in Khayelitsha. What we find is they come out for something like a show, right? So at these free events that we throw, my MPO, what we do is we give them that educational platform there. And whoever wants to attach, they can attach themselves as well to learn further. This is besides going school to school. We still find the same issues. Why? Because of society's norms. Society's norms. So, okay, Auntie Heather's kid got raped, etc. Instead of supporting each other and saying, my child is your child, and it takes a village to raise a child, no. What do? We go and gossip. So that little girl grows up stigmatized, and then the reaction is like a chain reaction in a community, and that's what happens. So instead of coming out, and there is multiple resources, but nobody comes out, like you said, it's only located at one spot. So there's nothing pumped into creating things like, for example, the homeless people that we feed. There's no haven for them. There's one haven, there's one old age home, and there's one care center. In an area that, for example, Mitchell's Plain supports 1.2 million and growing, how is this possible? Why? So now we go school to school, we try, but a lot of people is not reached. And then you look at your safety measures, etc. At our last event that we had, we worked in an area called Lentegia, and I'm not going to mention names, but one of the most renowned gangs came out. And I was so shocked and surprised to see that they actually, the gang members themselves, wanted to learn. They actually brought their families out. They actually got interactive. They got educated. They learned about things. So for me, it is also coming back, lack of education. So we suck in the system to grow into the system and die within the system.
I think, let me just add that what can be done at the family level. You know, for us, we are fortunate enough, the Witega Peace and Development Initiative, because with the help of BNP Paribas and the RCS, they are funding us to train members of the family in terms of peace building and entrepreneurship. So the 46 youth that we have already taken, there's still room for more than 200 people that we can bring in and train them in terms of peace building from the family level. So, and we also partnering with some of the schools that while we're having an intervention in schools, at the family level, we're also having an intervention both in terms of training them peaceful, peace building and non-violent alternatives. But at the same time, also understand their socio-economic situation of the family or household in terms of what can we do, how can we help you. That's where we are identifying an entrepreneurship within the household, if possible, so that we have got the two interventions going together and we'll be able to evaluate the impact on the family or on the local level.
Just adding to that, and coming from a kind of a peace studies perspective, so theories about peace, one of the key aspects for a peaceful society, apart from greater equality, both in terms of socioeconomic access, justice, gender, those kind of issues, is around peace education. And peace education, in essence, is about people find non-violent, non-aggressive ways of resolving disputes. So we conducted a study a number of years ago that was from a representative sample of Cape Town youth, and we've, you know, followed them over a number of years and kind of asked questions about the family. And one of the key drivers or determinants of violence in the family context had to do with fighting in the family. So the sense of around, as previous speakers have indicated, you know, sort of the violence that's taking place, people are shouting at each other, people are hitting each other, kind of, you know, being condescending towards each other. And that was a particular, which would, the research showed as a kind of key driver of this. And so if one is going to respond to that issue, it's about having the resources at scale. It's about having training and conflict resolution and mediation specifically for families and families in at-risk areas. And we don't have that. Those resources aren't there anymore. We used to have NGOs that focused on conflict resolution that tried to kind of get this kind of work done at kind of scale and get government to support it. But we don't even have peace education in schools. Let me leave it at that.
Yeah.
Can I just, because Guy touched on something very important, you know, and that what we used to have, because I come from a history of in civil society, and the NGO world was alive in there. We did a lot of work. And I listened to the minister saying that SAPS, of course we all know what SAPS is, you know, nobody can deny that. However, we cannot depend on SAPS only to address issues of crime. We cannot depend on SAPS to come and make our communities better. That is not their job. Because I know a lot of people in SAPS who has to also act as social workers, which is not their job. There are two different jobs. There's a social worker and there's a police officer. And we do expect police officers very often to act as a social worker as well, which is wrong, because then it means that we're not looking at the social aspect of crime, and then we're not addressing it. And I do not want to go into that specifically, but the city of Cape Town and civil society and government's interaction on civil society, it is so dire. Because civil society is dying out, and those who are still operating are struggling, because you have to make yourself valid around every turn. And the work you do suffers, because the work you do is now the lesser, because you need to first establish yourself as a legitimate NGO, whether you've been running for years or not, and whether you've had successes. So, yes, we do need SAPS to be sorted out. We need it desperately. However, we need to start looking at our NGO sector. We need to start looking at our social work. You know, how many social workers are out there in our communities, for our communities? How many social workers actually are fully trained, completely trained in the work they are supposed to do? Because those people are burdened with the problems that we're sitting with in our communities.
Yes, yes. Thank you, Wilhelmina.
I just wanted to add, I think most of the things are interconnected, you know. The government is at the center of it, because they can manage to alleviate some of this problem by providing funding to struggling NGOs, even though that they've closed, who are making an impact. Let's, for example, think about gender-based violence. In the way it has been spread now, in the absence of a number of NGOs that have closed down, these have been called upon to assist. So whenever I think we're looking at the issue of violence, we have to think broad and get worried and even declare that we are on fire. Because the xenophobic attack or Afrophobia attack, whichever way way you want it to take, because there's been a black against black or African against African, so it's Afrophobia. But people would play with the terms and so on, or xenophobia, which is normal. People are asking, what is wrong with South Africa? What is wrong that you have to be violent like this? How can you be smiling when these things happen? So these are fundamental questions that ourselves you need to answer. Where are we getting it wrong that violence has to come to this extent?
Yes.
How women are being killed instead of being protected by somebody that loves them, you know? That's the first place that we can feel refuge, feel peaceful and protected. But yeah, we are the same men that were in the forefront. So we have to ask, what has gone wrong? Who has to bring this awareness? What type of education is... Because as Guy said, there have been a number of research that have dug out in terms of the extent of violence, what causes violence. But for me, we need now to see what are the interventions. And we cannot be speaking loud in terms of one part, what we can see, NGO, how they're struggling, but they make a greatest impact in all what is going through now, you know, whether it's just gender-based violence, xenophobia, in terms of the general lawlessness, you know. So there is a way that we have to wake up and see that how do we address the root causes for this. While we're doing that, we're going to plead to government to reduce corruption, because the money that goes into corruption can fund all struggling NGOs and make an impact. Even awareness that men can understand that no from a woman is a no. It doesn't mean any other thing, you know. But this we need now and again the message to pass through so that it gets into the minds and the inner being of people that will be transformed. So the next generation can be safe. Children, even people that are involved in gangs, we have spoken to some of them and said, I'm afraid I might be shot from the back. So no one is at peace whenever there's violence.
Yes, like one of the people on the recording said, you know, she walks around with this fear. You know, you get out of your car, you want to make sure that you're safe before you, and it's escalated in the past couple of weeks, that feeling of being unsafe because of what has happened in the past couple of weeks. And yes, Chance mentioned the xenophobic violence, and one of the questions that we had that come through was about the xenophobic violence. So I just want to read that. Xenophobic violence appears to be cyclical, the latest incidents echoing those of 2015, 2016, and 2017. Economic competition has been cited as the cause of the riots, with foreign-owned businesses looted and destroyed. Would economic empowerment, like greater access to jobs for local people, lessen tensions, or do hostilities run deeper than that? So I think to a certain extent, Chance, you've answered some of that. It does run deeper than that. But it always comes back to, as the recording also, when we spoke with people, said unemployment is a huge cause of that. And that's something that, despite the fact that we're saying the government needs to do something, like we need to do something, communities need to do something. So what can be done then?
Oh, yes, can I go for it? So there's so much that can be done.
Yes.
There's so much. So many of our participants have thrived off doing, okay, for example, in Bree Street, you get your first Thursdays, doing artwork and selling the artwork, getting platforms to sell the artwork, writing their own music and getting out there, becoming something as simple as modeling for a clothing brand, then growing your own food. This is something we totally ignore. It's a seed. It costs 10 rand a packet at ShopRite. I always tell my participants, go to ShopRite, buy the packet of seeds, put the seeds in the ground, water it. What starts growing? Your food. Your food, basic meal. We call it meal. You know, your flour that you put together with your salt and bake bread. Learn to clay. Build a clay oven. Put that bread in there. Put that things that have been grown, and you've got your meal. You do not need to kill somebody for your next meal. I like also what you said previously about the gangsters and being scared to be shot. But like I also mentioned, you'll be surprised how many of them, when introduced to this simple green lifestyle, change. They change because they're actually robbing someone for something as simple. It doesn't have to be your phone or the pen or whatever the case may be. It can be as simple as a slice of bread. And that's how the situation on a grassroots level, that's what it actually is. So a lot of people that's in a better off position, they look down and they're like, oh, they just want to be like that. No, there's no such thing as somebody wanting to be that way. It's your circumstances that you're faced with. So we have to look at it also. What a privileged people. If you look at it, research has shown, I've also worked for World Health Organization. Previously, that was my last position before we opened up the NPO. Research has shown these areas in Hermanus, for example, impoverished areas similar to Elsie's and Mitchell's Plain. It's what you are surrounded with, and it's the way things are structured, which I also find funny. It's like you have your Samora Michelle, you have your Mitchell's Plain in the middle, and then the outskirts going to your Athlone. We put in a specific geographical position, if you look at it from a satellite view, where certain people are placed in a nice position, and the same positions that I'm talking about, like a better stance that they put in, these are the better cultural, autistic environment is provided for this youth, better ways of living. We don't tell our kids in our schools, we don't tell our people that we work with that this is actually what you can do. Whereas if you go to those schools like Waldorf, I love mentioning them, they introduce that you can actually make money by doing something as beautiful as art, like what we can see over there. It's something as simple as that can be sold off, or a greener way of living. So self-sustainability and creating your own job. So from selling
your own clothing brand, for example. Things like that are things that we are totally oblivious to and that we don't teach our youth in our school systems that we have today.
Thanks, Zenit.
Just a very quick comment. There's a website where we've kind of been running, and it tries to showcase all the NGOs, community-based organizations that work in the violence prevention, crime prevention field. It's called Safer Spaces, saferspaces.org.za. And it's basically a kind of a type of community website. So anyone can kind of showcase their stuff there. So it's about you just ready kind of, you can register and then you upload information about your organization. So if anyone's interested in looking at it, there are a whole range of really interesting organizations that do work to try and make South Africa a safer and better place.
We do have one more question, and then I think we have to wrap it up. The crime stats came out today, and we were talking about it just before we came into the studio. It reveals higher sexual offences rates, and the recent Am I Next protests show that people are demanding change. Would imposing harsher sentences on sexual offenders bring about improvements?
Yes.
That's the question for Mota.
Yes, it would. It would, because you get a man, or at least I believe it fully. You have a man raping a 1-year-old child and getting bail. You know, I understand our legal system has to operate as a legal system. However, I've recently read about a rape case where the person who was raped was called in for mediation. How do you mediate on being raped? What do you mediate on? And the escalation, I do not believe there's been an escalation in the act of rape. I believe people are coming forward now and people are talking about it. And women are saying no, much more louder, because all of us are standing up and saying no together, you know. And it is being defied by government and by men much more louder, because you have a lot of men on social media coming out and saying, well, I'm not trash, but if you dress like a prostitute, what do you expect? If you have people of high males, of high standing, high positions coming out on social media and saying, if you're going to dress like a prostitute, don't cry rape. Because then you're effectively saying that I should dress the way you want me to dress, and prostitutes can get raped however much you want to rape them.
Yeah, and also, I mean, I think the problem with that statement is that sex workers are sex workers. And actually, when it comes to rape, it doesn't matter how you're dressed. Because
exactly.
We know that if a 1-year-old can be raped, then we know that. Okay, so I think we're going to wrap up now. Thank you so much for being in the studio with us.
Our pleasure.
It was a wonderful discussion. I'm looking forward to speaking to all of you a little bit more, and we'll share some of that information, a lot of the information, with Wish Radio as well. Thanks so much for coming
through.
Thank
you so much. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
89.5 FM.
Wish Radio 89.5.